Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The two hilarious women on today's show didn't actually share the screen that often on Saturday Night Live. But when they did, it was always magical.
Hello, I'm Margaret Jo McCullen.
And I'm Lynn Burchard.
And you're listening, to The Delicious Dish on National Public Radio. Well, Lynn, faith in Bagora, I'm happy to say that one of our all-time favorite holidays is upon us.
St. Patrick's Day.
Now, for most of us, this lusty and raucous celebration means one thing above all else.
Gathering with rowdy friends to convivially overindulge in that nectar of the gods.
Bicarbonate of soda.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Rachel Dratch and Anna Gasteyer on SNL as the co-hosts of NPR's The Delicious Dish, after Dratch took over for Molly Shannon. Rachel and Anna joined me on Zoom from an undisclosed hotel in New York to talk about A Clusterfunk Christmas, their new meticulous parody of Hallmark and Lifetime Christmas movies that premiered on Comedy Central this past weekend. But mostly we talked about the ups and downs of their time on SNL. Anna Gasteyer joined the show in 1996, when it was making its transition from the male-dominated days of Chris Farley and Adam Sandler to a cast that included a parade of hilarious women, including Molly Shannon, Sherry O'Terry, and eventually Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph, and Rachel Dratch, who signed on in 1999. This episode contains a lot of really funny stories about SNL, from both behind the scenes and inside the legendary after parties. But we also talked about the unique challenges that both women faced when they ultimately left the show, compared to their male counterparts. I thought this was just a really fun and fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoy it too. So here's me with Rachel Dratch and Anna Gasteyer.
Hi. Sorry we're late. We got distracted.
Oh, you guys are together. That's exciting. I didn't know if you'd be beaming in from separate places or not. Where are you guys? Are you in a kind of a hotel?
Undisclosed
hotel. Location in New York. She just revealed.
It's the Plaza.
Very top secret.
No, we're in this hotel in New York.
Our own apartments are very noisy.
Well, thank you guys for doing this. I'm very excited to have both of you together on the podcast. And I just got to see the movie, A Clusterfunk Christmas. I wasn't sure if it was a cluster funke Christmas or a clusterfunk Christmas, but I think
it sort of depends if you're from the old country.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But it's a really, the movie is so much fun. It's really got me in the holiday spirit early, which was nice.
That was the goal. How exciting. If it didn't, that would be sad.
Yeah. This is something that's been in the works for a while, right? I know it was sort of a pre-COVID project that kind of... So what's the backstory there?
Yes, it was just very briefly pre-COVID. We sold it at the very end of 2019 in December. And then actually we're just about to start to get into writing it when we went into the lockdown. And the lockdown was sort of a lucky break for us because it created time and space where we could actually write a movie together. even though it was happening like this virtually, we were both over FaceTime and Zoom and whatever. But and then last summer was pretty hairy still in terms of the virus and things like that. So we managed to pull it up for July 2021 and banged it out in Vancouver. And here we are.
Yeah,
peddling our wares.
I liked the Vancouver vibes. It felt very Canadian.
Our collaborator Danielle von Zernick has produced a ton of Hallmark and Lifetime movies in her real life, in addition to other projects. And so when we got together, sort of the idea was like bring the comedy minds and the Hallmark minds together to sort of make the best parody that we possibly could. And it was really important to Rachel and to me that was very structurally sound, that it really felt like a Hallmark Christmas movie or Lifetime Christmas movie, because the more by the numbers, the more fun we could kind of have with it, if that makes any sense. So that was the brainchild. And we worked with an amazing collaborator as well, Michael Murray, who has written over 20 of these things. We call him the Christmas Whisperer. He's like, goes back all the way to like the Columbo Christmas special, I think was his very first Christmas movie. And he was an incredible advisor because there are all of these like tricks of the trade that we really wanted to have fun with. And if you are a student of these movies, even if you love them or love to hate them, there are all these things like they always have, they never have a good big budget. They shoot them fast. They crank them out in July in Vancouver. And that was sort of important to us to emulate a bunch of that stuff. So definitely to get some Canadian references and day players and not very many extras and, you know, just some of the kind of more bird's eye comedy in terms of like the making of jokes.
You mentioned sort of the structure, but were there other really specific tropes that you really wanted to make sure you included?
Well, I have a friend who watches all these movies religiously, and she sent me the most hilarious breakdown of this, the six plots that you might have, you know? So the one that we picked was the one that most people know, which is like, big city, bitchy executive with no time for love or Christmas gets sent to a small town to buy up a local business and meets a hunky local and, you know, the rest is...
Abandons her
Christmas.
Regular life for yeah. Christmas magic.
So that's the one that we sort of picked, but then we tried to put in a bunch of other little tropes here and there. Like, you know, there's what's like the dog who saves Christmas or whatever. So every little thing we could think of on the way, like, you know, at one point we had a big musical number break up. Like we had to cut that for
oh, really?
The budget and time. So, and then all the little, you know, more little tropes along the way that we would sort of stumble into.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, everything from, and also just, you know, honestly, these are really white bread, really earnest comedies. And I think we had a really good time with kind of winking at that as well. Sort of, you know, the way that they traditionally have treated, you know, gender and sexuality roles, race, and, you know, all kinds of things. So we tried to touch upon a lot of what we thought was pretty hyper stereotypical about the movies.
Yeah, the runner with the guy she meets who may or may not be gay is pretty funny. Is that something that came from that you've actually seen in these movies, or was
oh,
that?
Oh, definitely. There's always a platonic confidant friend, and so by default, he's clearly gay, but nobody can ever say it out loud because
yeah,
it's a Hallmark.
Because it's
movie,
Hallmark,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we had fun with that, and then sort of in the more recent ones, the idea of like a super stereotypical gay friend. So we kind of had fun with whatever the line is in between those two things, and our actor Nils Hagestad is really fantastic. He really leaned into it and had a good time with it. So,
and was the plan always for the two of you to play the two owners of the inn?
Well, we knew, like Anna and I know that wigs and glasses are our bread and butter. So when we knew we were writing one of these, we knew we weren't going to be the romantic lead in any way, shape, or form. So it's like, of course, we're playing these spinster, gray-haired fund aunts who run the inn. It was just like, oh yeah, that's a given. Like there wasn't a lot of talk about that.
Oh, well, where are you coming in from, hon?
New York City.
Oh,
New York. Never been there myself. Mm-mm. Too many lights, honking horns.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, all that hustle and bustle.
That's a great story. Could I just get my key?
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. In New York City, can you see the stars when you look up at the sky?
Not really. Not with all the lights. No stars? How are you gonna make a wish?
And there's also sort of a trope therein as well that we were trying to kind of call attention to, which is in these movies, you tend to have sort of the fresh young hottie who's come looking for a lumberjack, or you have like a 350-year-old homespun woman who gives homespun and stage advice. So you kind of don't have a lot of just like gender roles outside of those things as Mrs. Claus or Cinderella.
You also have makeovers. So.
And you do have makeovers.
Oh, yeah.
So we
get to see
also
you. There's some makeover montages that we get to see, which is very
yes.
exciting.
Yeah. Several makeovers.
Yeah. We gave us opportunity for makeovers as well. So it's all part of the genre and it's all sort of what's to be expected. And it's really fun when you meet a fan of the genre too, because they're like, well, do they have a, you know, whatever it is. Like, so do they go to the country? Do they go to the inn? Do they go to, you know, is it going to be turned
yeah,
into
they
a,
really know.
Yeah,
well, I have to admit that I am not a religious watcher of these films, but I still quite enjoyed it. And
oh,
I feel like I got the parody even without being super familiar with the source material. So I think that's a positive.
Good to know.
That's a huge positive, actually, because it's a movie for comedy fans and it's a movie for Hallmark kind of fans and it's a movie for Hallmark hate watchers. You know, it's all everything in between. And I think the holidays are like that. They're sort of like treacly, in spite of themselves. They're traditional in spite of themselves. We kind of want the feel good, even if we want to laugh, you know, so there's this kind of willingness to have something that you can settle back in and enjoy a tradition around instead of being cynical about it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, wigs and costumes and funny costumes are your bread and butter. And I know that really probably goes all the way back to the, you know, very early days with you, Rachel, at Second City and Anna at the Groundlings. And you kind of come from these two separate, very, you know, major comedy institutions. I was curious if you, because I'm sure you're more familiar with the one that you were at, but how would you describe each one and sort of the differences? And is there any rivalry there, or is it sort of they just exist in separate worlds?
I think they kind of just exist in separate worlds. I mean, I know when I was coming up, those were like the two places that SNL scouted. Like that was it back
then. That was it, yeah.
So if you ever...
No UCB, even, no...
No, yeah. And like, you know, they may take a few stand-ups, but there wasn't like, the internet didn't exist.
Right.
So it wasn't like you could get
TikTok stars,
seen
yeah.
because you have this following, right? That just wasn't even there. So those were the two places you went. So it's sort of like, you know, you'd end up at either one of those places and you'd eventually, you don't go there like, I'm going to be on SNL. You just go to like, try to make it in the improv comedy world and you like slowly move your way up and everything. But then you also know those aren't the only two places really that SNL would scout. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel like Groundlings was more about like characters that like directly transferable to SNL was. And Second City was a little bit more in my mind, like theatrical.
Organic.
Like, we would do like a whole show that was the same every night for months and months, and then we would have an improv set after the show every night. So it was almost like a theatrical piece, sort of. I don't know if the Groundlings.
Yeah, I mean, and also the Groundlings program. Like, in order to make it to the main stage, there, at least when I was there, you have to graduate up through it. So everybody has a certain base level of training that's in common, and they do treat writing comedy as its own thing. So there's I think now there's two writers' labs, and a lot of it is like developing a character monologue, developing, you know, and then by the time you're on the performing stages, the Sunday company or the main company, it's almost identical to SNL. Actually, you're mounting material on Wednesday, and then if it makes it, it's going up on Sunday, like over.
Yeah, it's really like a training ground.
It really is. So, I mean, not intentionally, but that's, and collaborative and all of that. So, and then same thing, improv set. The Groundling show is structured as sketches with improv games and throughout. And then like there's three or four all improv sets weekly. So very similar. I mean, I went to college in Chicago and it was like a very simple, I was going to stay and try to do the Second City. And then somebody convinced me to move to LA for a completely different reason. So, and then I was like, oh, I got to do the Groundlings. Like it just, they were pretty six of one half dozen in my mind back then.
I would say so. Yeah.
Do you feel like the Groundlings prepared you for SNL better than maybe Second City prepared you for SNL, Rachel?
It's so hard to say because I don't know if anyone really feels like prepared when you get an SNL. Like there's so much different there, even coming from Sketchland. So it's hard to say not having done both, but I think in both of them you had to develop characters and try to write, and that's, you know, obviously like a giant thing at SNL. So
yeah, for sure.
But one thing they both have that's helped along the way so much is they're both ensemble based. Mm-hmm. And so like we're very used to collaborating and very used to, you know, relying on some, you know, if you're in an improv scene that's dying, you know, like someone's going to have your back as opposed to like stand up, which I've never done, but you know, cause then when you're bombing, you're like bombing on your own. But like the idea that you're all building something great together or you're all like saving each other's ass,
ship's going down,
depending on what the night is like. So that feeling of collaboration, you know, carries over to SNL, same thing.
For sure.
Because I've always enjoyed writing with other people. And
yeah, it's super tribal. I mean, I went to Northwestern to be a voice major. I was supposed to be like a singer. My parents thought I was going to be an opera singer, literally. So I mean, I didn't want to be, but that was like what the plan was. And I got there and I met the improv people and it was literally tribal. It was like, I just found my people, like for the first time in my life. Like I was like, you know, it was Northwestern has a big Greek system. I was like, I don't want to be a sorority, whatever. This was like a major click. And I mean, click with a CK, not a QUE, although we were probably kind of clicky. but the same thing, like the Groundlings felt that way. Second City, I'm sure, felt that way. IO, UCB, like, but then that sort of graduates into like the larger company of humans who do this kind of work. It's just, I remember we went back, Betty White hosted for Mother's Day about 10 years ago. And the women of our, of several eras went back to celebrate Mother's Day and write the show. And it was just this, like, this was long after we kind of graduated from SNL and we were all doing, you know, Rachel had done some Broadway shows. I had done some film, TV, everybody was doing different things. and experience show business really outside of that world, and coming home and just the sense of like true family reunion and whatever you want to call it, like, you know, you can never leave the mob, or like, it was just the sense of like, oh, we're mutants. Like, we all have this thing that where I can collaborate with people across the board in entertainment, I feel such a profound kinship with people who come from comedy and improv background.
Yeah. I mean, you guys both had, I think, a very strong female cohorts at Groundlings and Second City, and then also at SNL, which kind of goes against, there's, you know, some idea that comedy is a boys' club and that certain aspects of comedy are, but it seems like that really wasn't the case for you in either of those places or SNL. Or how do you think about it?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, we get asked a lot about, like, SNL, was it hard for women? I think maybe before my time, like, I can't speak to that because maybe it was, but I feel like it was always pretty equal ground. Like, I mean, it's a hard place to get your scenes on, you know, no matter what your gender, really. But it's like, if your scene killed at the table, like, and, you know, it had a shot of getting on, it wasn't like, that's lady humor, for the most part, that I ever experienced. And then, like, the women are so strong the whole time through. I mean, when I was there, I felt like I was working with very strong women comedians. And then, you know, even afterwards, the whole time, like, the cast now and...
Yeah, I mean, not, I don't want to get too political about it, but it, you know, look, after is probably where the rubber meets the road on some sexism. Like, you know, the opportunities That's afforded true. To our peers, and not that they're undeserving, but you may have been a highly successful sketch comedian with millions of recurring characters. And that's one of the reasons I stayed and did Broadway, because I was like, I don't really want to like fight for the three parts that are going to be, I left the show in 2002. It was a very different world before Kristen wrote Bridesmaids. And even for a few years thereafter, I mean, I think opportunities like this movie that Rachel and I have written are becoming more and more prevalent all the time. But I'm not sure, honestly, that we would have been able to sell it 15 years ago. Like, it's been really fun to kind of, we worked with an entirely female set of cohorts. We had a female director, our co-collaborator, Daniel Van Zernick, all the executive producers are women. So it's a very different, I think the landscape's changed significantly, but I've been off the show now for, you know, 19 years. So, I would say just graduating the show, I was really blatantly told, just to get dirty about it, like, by a big male comedy manager, like, you're not going to work in film. We need to try to get you a TV deal. And frankly, it was all wives at that point. So it's just, it has changed. It has changed partially because of people like Tina and Amy and our, you know, colleagues who have pushed that boulder uphill, but it's, and because culture has changed, society's changed, you know, that things move along. So,
yeah. I mean, when you think about the kind of opportunities that came to, you know, Will Ferrell and Jimmy Fallon when they left the show, it was, you know, it's different.
And again, they're not undeserving. Like,
right.
They're
of course
phenomenally
not.
Deserving. But I would say that, yeah, those opportunities came fast and to boys.
Can we go back to when you two first met each other? Was it at SNL that you met for the first time?
Yeah. Anna was already on the show, had been for a couple of years, and then I came on as a new hire. And so, you know, like, when you first get hired at SNL, I mean, my experience is like, you're like tiptoeing in, you know, trying to learn the ropes, and you're kind of thrown into the pool, you know, like, so it's just,
there's no orientation.
Like, write a sketch and hope it gets on.
Yeah.
There's definitely no like orientation. You're sort of like swept up as the new person. And then, you know, as you've been there longer, you're going to see someone else come in. But yeah, Anna was always one of my favorite cast members when I was watching the show as a mere citizen before I got on. So as we were saying, like, we don't have it. Like, she always makes me laugh, and I just always love her comedy. We didn't have anything like some sketch together.
No,
it was like, here comes Scratch and Gasser.
I know. Which is funny.
Know, right?
We worked together a lot, actually.
We tried. We wrote a few things.
We wrote a number of duds. Big bombs.
Really? I want to hear about those. What were your duds?
We were trying to do one where we were at a garage sale.
Yeah, that was a flop.
And it was a flop. We thought it was hilarious. We were two ladies sitting in lawn chairs.
We wrote like folk, telling folky people women's. I just remember singing like a folk song.
Oh, we did do a scene where we played real life gay couple, and it was part of like a
dude's parodying like guys.
It probably would
looking,
get us canceled.
Yeah, we would be canceled. We can't.
But at the time,
but that one aired.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
That one aired. Yeah.
Very.
I gotta find that one.
Oh. Yeah, it's not worth your time.
I thought it was funny.
We did. But was our fan favorite? Really?
If I said what the plot was now, I would probably get canceled. But if you watch it, Well, don't go look for it.
That's a good politics.
I thought it was funny.
It's like it was funny.
It's about the actually male making gaze. Fun of like a frat boy.
Yeah, it's about making fun of the way guys look at women on camera. Yeah.
Oh, mighty amulet of wishes. I call upon your awesome power for my third and final wish. Please bestow upon us two real life lady lovers so we can watch them do their thing until we bust a nut.
Honey, remind me to buy bulgur tomorrow. We're supposed to bring a side dish to Cheryl's Equinox dinner.
Is it the Equinox already? I swear to Gaia, it seems like just yesterday was solstice.
You smell great. Were you working with the bees today?
No, it's that hemp soap you bought me in Provincetown.
It's driving me crazy.
What the hell is that?
We've done a lot since the show, actually, partially just by nature of the fact that, like, we're a small little tribe of women and we tend to all kind of populate the same projects and stuff like that. But like Tina put us in her show, Great News. We played Kathy Lee and Hoda. Kind of.
Oh, yeah. That was great. Yeah. I love that show.
So much fun. And it was, and, you know, of course, we did Wine Country and we've hosted a lot of things together, you know, in the world of comedy, you get called upon to host for charities and things like that. So we've actually done a fair amount of just goof around collaboration. And this was our first real effort at, like, also I'd never written a full length script. I'd written.
Yeah. It's a lot different than writing sketches.
Very different than sketches.
It feels like a math problem to me. Like,
yes,
I've had a lot of ideas for screenplays that I think are really good ideas. And then as a matter of fact, then I don't write them. And then I see, oh, someone else did it like 5 years later. And it was, but I don't have like the math brain of that, like putting together Act Three, then this happens.
Before we move on from the beginning of your time at SNL, Rachel, I was really interested to see, which I didn't remember, that your very first episode, I believe Norm Macdonald was the host, which he came back after he had been fired from the show to host, which I didn't even realize had happened. And I was just curious if you have any memories from that.
I'm going to be honest Norm with hosting. You. It was because I was just new, you know, fresh off the boat there. And so it was like the very first one was Seinfeld. And then the next week was Norm Macdonald.
Oh, okay.
And but I didn't make it into either show, which I don't know if that happens. I mean,
all the time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway,
sure.
Like, and it's like you tell. So my memory is like, you know, you tell your friends like, oh my God, I'm on SNL. And then like, you're not in it. And then the next week comes by like, you guys, I'm on SNL. I have a sketch. Like I wrote a sketch this week. It got picked. And then like it gets cut. So yeah. Whatever. I don't remember how. But anyway,
crying in your dressing
room. Wasn't in the show. Yeah. So, I mean, and also when you're that new, well, even like later, I'd been there years. I wouldn't be I'm pretty like shy. So I don't just go up to every host. Like, I love that thing
you did.
Blah, blah, blah. Because I just sort of was like quiet as a mouse, especially week two. So I really, unfortunately, have no stories or recollections or like
From that early on. Do either of you have a particularly memorable interaction with a host that either went well or not well?
Well, you know, it's what was always the sort of most, I mean, you know, again, you do 6 or 7 years of shows. It's literally in the hundreds of shows that you end up doing, and not in the hundreds, 120, 125 or something. I think I've once added up, but so it's hard. Like it's a lot of people, but what you do end up taking away from it is we always got the best version of people because they're terrified. They're sort of at the mercy of the cast and they are hoping that you can help them through I have to say, like, it's not easy hosting SNL. You have to have a ton of blind faith. You can't be a control freak. You have to like trust that the material's good, trust that the cast is going to take care of you, trust that Lauren's going to take care of you. And it's brave, you know? So it was very, very rare that you would see anything remotely resembling bad behavior. And even if you did, it tended to be masked terror. I mean, you know, like I had people like of enormous stature tell me they threw up on the plane. They were so nervous, you know? So, because it's terrifying. And also, by the way, they like get judged and criticized for how well they do or how well they don't in real time. And it's not for the faint of heart, you know?
Yeah. It's funny. It does create some weird power dynamics where there's like these massive celebrities, but they're like in your hands to make it work.
One other thing I noticed is sometimes the people that were the best, like actors, like people that have won Oscars and the most amazing actors, they wouldn't tend to do as well as someone that was like a politician or an athlete.
Athletes
like,
are incredible.
Because they're like, well, I don't care. I know I'm not good at this. Yeah. You know, like they don't, they're not trying to be good. So then they have no fear about it, or they're used to that athletic, whatever.
Right. Or like different, like different reactions to operating under stress. Too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're used to being under. And so they often would have the best shows.
Yeah. Like Christina Ricci came in and she was like, she had been famous since she was 7 years old, you know, from the Addams Family. And she was, you know, the celebrated actress. And it was her first time ever in front of a live audience. She confided in me. So it was like, you know, things like that, that you're just like, it's a funny way, like it's a different road to fame. And she, and Rachel's right. Like someone like Jeter, I remember it was so funny because he was amazing and just charming and lovely. And of course, everybody's complimenting him. You're doing so great. You're doing so great. And he I remember he leaned over to us and it was a sketch. Emily Spivey wrote it where he just got a perm and he was like super confident about his perm. So funny. Anyway, he was like, you guys don't have to like compliment me. People tell me I suck like every day. It doesn't bother me. So he just tell me. Like you could tell it almost bothered him. He was like, how can I improve? You know, because he's an athlete. So he's just used to like operating under pressure, operating well. And if you really think about like baseball in particular, it's so solo. They're all by themselves every time.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's a lot of failure. It's like, yeah, that's, you know, if you're doing it, if you're hitting a third of the time, then you're succeeding. So,
but to that point, when you were talking about the power dynamic, which is hilarious, because, you know, we have these storied parties. Rachel reminded me of this story the other day. Those giant parties after the show and late nights and so on and so forth. And Jeter had just, he hosted and we went to the party and then there was an after party and he had just purchased like a massive, glorious apartment that week. He was like, oh, it's so weird. I'm moving that week. We're like, we're moving. Like, and we're all imagining like, cause we're like, you know, taking the subway to work and we're imagining like paying our friends in pizza to move us.
Yeah,
and literally.
That's not how Derek Jeter moves.
No, it was at the time Warner Center. And it was like this penthouse, just like, you know, gorgeous Central Park views. And we were like, oh, well, he just moved in. It's your story. Do you want to help?
Oh, no. I was just going to, I'm like, it was in June. I'm like, you know that thing? Like, because it was over by the UN. And I just had to fact check you on that.
Oh, it wasn't.
It wasn't Warner? Central Park views.
Oh, you're right.
Anyway, that doesn't even matter.
It was jetliner views.
The point is.
As they say in real estate.
This never happened, by the way. But the one time is that he was like, hey, everyone can come back to my apartment.
Come back to my place. Yeah, that
so
doesn't happen every week.
To his apartment
everyone goes, and
after,
it's like
after.
Completely set up. Every picture's on the wall.
There's glasses in the
like
cabinets.
The silverware was on all the right places. And we were like, I don't understand. You moved yesterday.
Yeah, you thought there were any boxes everywhere.
Yeah, it was just
there
like
was nary a box.
And nary a minion. You saw nobody who had like skittered in the dead of night and put together Derek Jeter's apartment and then left.
And ready
we
for
just
a party.
Like, wow. We are definitely the plebes on this story. Like, you know, we've gone from our week of status to our like absolute, like the opposite. Like, do you think we could charge us for the beers? You know, yeah, exactly.
Coming up, more SNL stories, including the biggest party of the show's history for its 40th anniversary, and why Rachel Dratch had so much fun returning to the show to play Amy Klobuchar during the 2020 election.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. We have had a ton of SNL alums on this show over the years, including Martin Short, Sarah Silverman, Colin Quinn, and many more. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Rachel Dratch and Anna Gasteyer.
I do feel like the Christmas episodes of SNL have gotten sort of bigger and bigger as the years have gone on, and then and people coming back for, because it's the last episode of the year usually. So I was curious if you have any memories of specific SNL Christmas memories that stand out that you love.
Well, sort of to Rachel's thing about like being new at the show, from oddly, all my like sort of big successes from the show happened around Christmas. So Sweaty Balls happened on NPR. Yes. The Martha Stewart's Topless Christmas happened. Like it's funny that it was always like a really, it's like it's just a nice time of year for me, it seems like, creatively.
Well, Pete, Terry and I have been looking forward to having you on the show because we know you're the master of all kinds of Christmas goodies. Tell us about them.
Well, there are lots of great treats this time of year. Zucchini bread, fruitcake. But the thing that I most like to bring out at this time of the year are my balls.
Balls. Tell us about your balls, Pete.
Well, over at Season's Eatings, we have balls for every taste. Popcorn balls, cheese balls, rum balls, you name it.
Wow. My mouth's watering just thinking about those balls.
So I have fond memories of all of those. Like, and even then, I mean, we would have, you know, like Vanessa Williams and the New York Philharmonic. Like, it was always a cool, the Christmas show was always sort of fabulous. There were a couple where we, like, I don't know if they still do it, where they would take you down to the rink.
Oh, yeah. So then at the end of the night, for good nights, you would go run down, like,
terrifying.
Down this weird elevator system you never used.
You're like up
and
in 30
you
Rock,
put on
right?
skates and frolicky skating outfits. And
like Courier and Ives, like, yeah.
And then you would skate around. That was so fun.
But it was so fun. It was like a 2-minute costume change. So you would be like running and costuming to get into these elevators to get everybody down there to be photographed for good nights on there.
But the thing about SNL that was so fun, like, I mean, you know, it has like total ups and downs. Like the down for me was like, trying to write every week and, you know, trying to come up with characters and hoping you get on the show and all that stuff. But just like that pressure is what I mean. But then it's like, so it's this like rarefied dream job where of course you've grown up watching it. And then, oh my gosh, you're on it. Like I still would pinch myself, you know, after years of being on the show. But then like the idea that, you know, anyone could drop by and anything could happen. Like I remember, this was after I was off the show, but Mick Jagger was either like hosting or he was the musical guest at the end of the year show, the season finale.
Right, right.
Yes,
and
yes.
So party's always the most fun. I'm just talking about parties instead of the actual, instead of the work.
Oh, parties are fun.
But so the end of the year party is so fun because it's out in Rockefeller Plaza, you know, it's like under the stars. Now, like 8 out of the 9 years I went, it poured rain and was freezing cold and you could never have this party. But there was this one year, as I said, I was on the show, and Mick Jagger got up with the Foo Fighters, or Dave Grohl at least. And anyway, they played outside. It was like 2 in the morning. And Mick Jagger singing. I was imagining anyone like walking by.
That's my mind.
Is that Mick? I couldn't imagine someone who happened to walk by and like look down, and there's Mick Jagger.
Yeah, was that Kristen Wiig's last show? I think was that when he because he serenaded her in her last show. Yeah, on air. So that was pretty great.
Oh right, yes, she's like a rainbow thing. Yes, it's still coming back to me. Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, as long as we're talking about parties, I think the most legendary party of all is, of course, the SNL 40 party. Do you have any memories that stick out from that night? Either because you were both on the show too that night, right?
It's like a rabbit hole. I mean, it literally was like a drug trip. I mean, that week was so surreal, as I'm sure everybody's talked about with you, but and it's storied by now. But I like took to my bed. It was so for 2 days. It was so adrenal. Like everywhere you turned, the most incredible sort of titans of every aspect of American culture. So that entire week was sort of this evolving. We did a Bobby and Marty on that show, the middle school music teachers. And so the week starts strong with just like, oh, this is a homecoming week. And like Cheryl Hardrick, like the original musical director of the show, who used to write Bobby and Marty, is there. And Mark Shaman, and like, who wrote Hairspray, who's play for the show. Like we're in the room. So already it's this sort of who's who of like the comedy musical geniuses of American culture. And then like, you know, so you inside baseball, you know, and then you've got like Will Ferrell and Paula Pell, who wrote the sketch with us. And then as the week progresses, then we go with, and it was all amongst the sort of musical acts. And then you're with like you know, I mean, in comedic musical acts. So you've got everyone from like Opera Man to like Steve Martin,
yeah,
and the banjo.
That was a great
and, like,
section.
Every single Maya and Marty, and like every single where you turn, you're like, oh my God, there's just like a bigger star than the last time I turned around. Kristen and Fred, blah, blah, blah. It just keeps going. And then literally, so then I remember thinking, because my daughter was like a middle schooler, and I was like, I've got to bring her to the show. She's got to memorize in her mind the number of legends that are just in this building. Billy Crystal, you know, everybody's there. And we go in, and like immediately, like everyone was there. Immediately she sees, it was so perfectly SNL, Bradley Cooper and Kerry Washington. They're like, it was like, so she's, and oh, and you know, a Timberlake right away. And so all she can think about is like the celebrities. And I was like, okay, you're missing the point, but that's sort of like the whole show, right? And then the show goes on. There was like this party that all the girls were invited to of the show. And at that party, you're like, you know, Peyton Manning and like Katie Couric. I remember it was like the weirdest collection of hyper fame. Like it was, and I think it was Jagger. And I mean, it was just this super mind-blowing group of literally everybody, everyone had ever heard of was there in American culture. At the show itself, like Sarah Palin was there, Taylor Swift was there. It was like, didn't stop. And then to go to that party, and I mean, the most memorable moment, of course, now, especially in history, you know, because we had, at one point, I'm sure you've heard, like, the B-52s were up there, David Byrne was up there, I mean, everybody. And then I remember, like, the seas parting, and everything was like, there was like a rustling and a whispering and turning, and then Prince just walking by,
mm-hmm,
and heading up there.
Floating by.
It was insane. Yeah. It really was insane.
Yeah. No, that's crazy.
And I took to my bed.
And I think also for both of you.
Oh, and Beyonce and Jay-Z, right.
Yes.
Insane.
For both of you to kind of be part of the show too. And it really, I feel like that show, that special, you know, codified who are the iconic SNL characters from over the years. And as you said, you did Bobby and Marty with Will and Rachel, did you do Debbie Downer on that?
I think I did like a little, like one little intro line thing as Debbie Downer.
Yeah.
From the Californians.
Back to Mr. Bill. Oh no!
Bring it on down to SNL.
Taught us that opening the show with a musical number leads to a sharp drop in ratings.
Really, it shows you, you know, which are the most memorable characters. Are those, is that the one that you get people come up to you the most about, Debbie Downer?
Me, yeah, probably Debbie Downer. Sometimes the lovers in the hot tub.
Oh yes, that's a good one too.
That's probably the other one. But yeah, Debbie Downer seems to be the thing people come up to me the most.
Is that ever awkward? Do they want you to kind of bum them out, or you?
Everyone's always like, oh my gosh, one time I was standing on a street corner. It was at night, and I was just like, you know, I was standing on a street corner.
As one does.
That doesn't sound good. But I was about to cross the street, and I heard these two people behind me, and one of them was like, you're being a Debbie Downer. And then I wanted to turn around and be like, actually, but I didn't.
You didn't do
but
it?
That would have been good. Actually, like, it's codified into language. Like, there are a few things that made it that way, and Debbie Downer did it. I was, you know, that Taika Waititi movie, Hunt for the Wilder People, where it's like about a kid, and it's
yeah,
beautiful.
It's a great movie,
In New Zealand. And literally, like, I was watching with my son last summer, and halfway through the movie, he turns around and goes, okay, Debbie Downer. Like, it's like this New Zealand,
that's,
you know, family
yeah.
film. Like, it's all over the world. People say it. Where people
I've conquered the world.
She's got, well, it's like Tina does it too. Like, mom jeans. Like, there's certain things.
Oh, yeah, mom
things
jeans.
That,
like, that's
didn't exist.
She created that term.
Yeah.
But people don't even realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of weird when there's like things like that, you know.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned earlier that it was kind of that there was challenges after you left the show. I'm always curious about the decision to leave. And obviously, you know, now there's someone like Keenan who's been there for like 20 years. And I also know it's not always your decision to leave. So I guess, was it for each of you, was it your decision to leave the cast, and how did you come to that decision, and was it a difficult one?
I would say now, I mean, as has been widely reported, culturally it's much more acceptable to come and go. We were really like, you either had to go do your projects or be on SNL. I mean, there back in the day,
yeah,
like
there wasn't room to do both.
Like, Lauren was, you know, very protective of the brand, and, you know, didn't even really like people to do like a lot of commercials and things like that. Now every cast member has like endorsements, literally,
and
you know,
side shows,
and, like, yeah, side,
right,
shows, yeah,
side,
exactly,
shows, side show, but yeah.
And
people,
yeah,
going off and doing other projects.
Yeah, so that became sort of, if you wanted to spread your wings a little bit or sort of figure out who you were a little bit, it just was very much an either or. The cast was smaller. It was just, you know, a more exact decision. And I definitely, like, I as I said, I have come to accept about myself that I am this person, I'm in the tribe, but there is a sense when you're doing a last minute show all the time for year in and year out, that you're just sort of pulling it off all the time. There's just this sense of like, did I fail? Like, I didn't, the best you could do is to not fail, you know, if that makes any sense. And I was very drawn, as I think Rachel was too, I don't want to speak for you, but to theater, to New York theater in particular, because it was highly ritualized. It was perfection. You could go in, you could make something better every night. You could kind of, you know, and I was more interested in my singing career at that point too. And I wanted to do Broadway shows. So that was, I had an opportunity I just didn't want to pass up on. And I had a baby and I was like, I don't really know if I can, I didn't want to leave. Again, now we probably could have hung around. I didn't want to leave after my best. I didn't want my work to peter out over like a 4-year period because I was at home with a baby and, you know, I didn't want to just, but now I feel like you could like just kind of tune in. Sometimes I wish I'd stay.
Yeah, but it is, I mean, it seems like a show that you have to give like, you know, 150% to, and it's,
yeah, I just wouldn't know how to phone it in there. I mean, I think some people are really capable of it, but I just, I mean that in the most complimentary way, like that they get written for, they come in, they land it and they leave. But I never really, during our time, like if somebody did the odd movie during it, like we'll do it old school or whatever, like it was very stressful on those people and it seemed hard to do. So that was my decision, for better or worse.
What about you, Rachel?
Well, mine was kind of like muddy. I think if I had been there like now, I think I would have, like now people stay for years and years.
Yeah.
And that's a thing. But back then it was kind of like 7 years, you know.
Yeah. 7 years and out. Yeah.
And also our contracts were 7 years.
Yeah, they were 7 years. And like just no one really, I mean, a few people were like, you know, rolled out, like, please stay. Like, I wasn't one of those people, but I don't mean that. Like, it just, that was how it worked. Yeah. Now I'm sort of envious of these people that, like,
I know,
are there for years and years. And
hop,
you know,
in and out, do a couple shows.
It seems kind of cool to me, but it just wasn't really like that back
then. Well, you
my contract was actually, I was the last of the 5-year contract. So also to speak to that, like, I'd stayed for 6. And I was like, oof, well, I've already stayed a year past my contract.
You felt like you were bonus. You were already in.
A little bit, yeah.
But Rachel, you have come back a bunch over the last few years, including to play Amy Klobuchar, which was a fun thing.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
That was so fun.
That's become this big, more and more trend on the show, is having, you know, people come back for those kind of. Is that fun for you?
Yeah, so fun. I mean, especially these political years when they, I don't know, and like when was that anyway? You can't keep time straight.
Blackout, yeah.
But yeah, that 1 year of the election, they did a lot of bringing in outside people or people that had been there. And it was so fun. I mean, I got the call on, you know, Thursday night or something. Like, are you in town? And can you be here? And it's basically like, because you kind of look like her. Like, that's what that was. Because, I mean, you know, it's not like I had some, like, burning Klobuchar impression. But anyway, so they brought me in and I thought, like, okay, that's it. You know, and then I was like, oh, what if she stays in this for a while? And that's what ended up
happening. She becomes president?
That definitely crossed my mind. But, No, it was super fun to go back, especially, you know, it's really fun to go back when you don't have like all of your hopes and dreams. Like, I hope
it's
my
whole life.
Yeah,
like, you've
no,
written
I'm
a sketch
sure.
And you really feel, you know, oh, this could be good. Then it gets cut or whatever. You're not in the show much. And like all that stuff, that's not there when you just come back to just do a fun little thing like that. So, and then, yeah, and then they kept bringing me back and it was a really fun year.
Let's go now to Senator Klobuchar.
Thank you, Rachel. I know some of you think I'm shaking because I'm nervous, but this is just my signature quivering bang. It's my spidey sense that tingles whenever we need a moderate to say, girl, we can't pay for that.
And it's also like, I'm sure you documented, it's the last show of its kind on television, meaning it's got a staff that's been there for 45 years in some cases. So, you know, there's so many people when you've worked there that you're still connected to that are still there. The traditions are the same. The people are the same.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
It does make me wonder, like, it has become so, I think maybe they're starting to do it a little less now, actually, but starting with Tina Fey as Palin and then Alec Baldwin as Trump, bringing in all these people, you do wonder sometimes whether it gives the actual cast that's there less opportunity. And I was curious how you would have felt when you were on the cast, I guess, if that had been happening, if so many people had been coming in, these big stars to play roles and maybe roles that could have gone to cast members.
It did cross my mind, like, oh, this could be a bummer if you're on the show. I mean,
we always had just, cameos, though.
Yeah, it happens.
The show's really got the perfect mix of famous people. And I mean, every week there would be somebody. I mean, when I was there, you know, Goodman played Linda Tripp in the Lewinsky trials. Yeah, so I mean, it was pretty standard fare for SNL.
So what I want to do now before we wrap up is our final segment is called The First Laugh. And I'm just going to ask you guys about some firsts in your career that we can run through and your life. So starting with, if you remember the first piece of comedy or one of the first that really made you laugh as a kid growing up.
Ooh. Oh my gosh. I remember, this is going like way, way back. I remember when I was like 3 or 4 years old, my parents watching Laugh-In and seeing Lily Tomlin as Edith Ann in the big chair.
Oh, yeah. The big chair.
And that's the truth. Like, I just remember like, whoa. And then like a little older, I remember, you know, maybe when I was in like third grade or something, like Carol Burnett and the first SNL, like Gilda Radner, yeah. Jane Curtin, Lorraine Newman. Like, I just remember
clear memories.
I mean, I'm listing all the ladies, but that's what I remember as
resonating with
first, very first, early. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Carol Burnett and all the characters, for sure. Edith Ann and Bob Newhart, actually. I remember as a kid just being like, not like I look back at it now and I'm like, I have no idea what that show is.
I know. It's like
psychiatry. Yeah. Literally, like,
but I know what you mean, though, because his deadpan.
His delivery and his timing, I just like was riveting as a kid. Like, I just wanted to say things like him, you know.
Or like Mary Tyler Moore, like Ted Baxter, my parents used to. Like, I just remember that thing.
Yes. Ted Baxter, like, we still reference him all the time. Like, we meet a kind of person who's like, oh, that's what Ted Baxter. And then actually comedy albums too. Like that's sort of a lost art, but I do remember like laying in bed and listening to Carlin and laying in bed and listening to, I mean, you know who, and Cosby. And back in the day, we didn't know. I was just on a recording. It was family friendly.
We used to listen to Monty Python. My friend had Monty Python record that we would listen to.
Hours.
Over and over. Yeah.
Hours. Just like revisiting comedy albums. And actually, Lily Tomlin, all of her holiday, I mean, holiday, listen to me, all of her comedy albums. Oh, and Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah. Do you each remember the first time actually performing comedy on stage? Where was it? What was the experience like? How did it go?
I remember, this is a really weird memory and it's not a good story, but I remember.
So get ready.
So get ready. Pull up a chair. I mean, okay. I did like a lot of shows. You know, I think theatrical kids do, like in high school, I mean, in elementary school or whatever. And I knew I was a good singer before I knew I was a comedian. But I remember I was doing just like a thing at morning assembly at my school. And we had to sell, literally it was like Madrigal tickets or something. And I acted out like a Madrigal in the most over-the-top dramatic way. And like crushing, like the entire high school audience laughing and being like, I think I'm doing something other people can't do. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was like this resonant. And then it really wasn't until college. I did when I started joining the improv group. And then I was like, oh, okay, got it. Yeah.
What was it the first time you
performed comedy on stage?
First of all, I was kind of like a class clown type in school, like in junior high and high school. So I'd be like shouting out little one-liners, much to the chagrin of my team. But the first time, like, performing, I remember I did Your Good Man Charlie Brown in high school, and I was Snoopy. And that part is very, like, I didn't know it at the time, but there's so much, like, perfect improv to be done in that part.
Yeah,
so
the physical comedy.
But it was my first time learning, like, oh, I could, like, add this little bit in here. And so that was, like, the first thing that comes to mind for that.
You're a natural Snoopy. I would have cast you as Snoopy.
You said that on SNL it took some time to get on, Rachel. I don't know about you, Anna, but do you remember the actual first sketch that you appeared in and what it felt like?
It's like being shot out of a terror can. I mean, yeah, I did an update feature. It was one of the things I'd auditioned with. It was an MTV VJ. It was like a pop culture, like...
Were you Kennedy?
Basically,
okay, yeah.
We named her Kincaid. But
right.
And that was my first show, and I did an update feature, and it was...
That's impressive.
That was the Cinder. But yeah, no, I literally remember thinking like, oh, this is cotton mouth. This is what people are referring to. Like, because my mouth was so dry. But once the sketch started and people started laughing, I was like riding the waves.
With its choose or lose voter registration campaign underway, MTV is emerging as an influential voice in the current presidential election. Here with a commentary is former host of MTV's political game show, Capital Hurl, VJ Kincaid. Hi, Kincaid.
Hello.
Kincaid here, giving you the lowdown on Electionville. Come November, you will totally exercise your greatest right as a citizen, the right to vote. But here's the huge injustice. We are confronted by a limited two-party system that produces homogenized candidates. And oh my God, I sound so serious right now. It's like I'm the professor on Gilligan's Island or something. Like, that's so embarrassing. It's like, dun, 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 a three-hour tour, a three-hour tour. Oh my God, I can't believe I remember that song. That is totally hilarious. I love that. Oh my God.
Mine was also gonna date me, but I used to do Calista Flockhart. Like I did it for my audition. Allie was the big thing. So that was my first, was doing her.
Can you still do Calista Flockhart?
It's hard because it's
visual.
It's audio. Pretty visual. Yeah,
it was very visual.
I saw it there for a minute.
You can't see the face.
It's like an NPR sketch.
Anyway, yeah.
Do you each have a memory about meeting a comedy hero? Maybe it was at SNL, maybe it was somewhere else, but that really, like, early on in your career, meeting someone who was a big comedy hero.
Well, everyone always asks, who's your favorite host? And I always go to those, like, people. Like, I mean, I think my first season, Dan Aykroyd hosted, and he was, like, the first person from that original cast that I met. And so I was just like talk about the pinch me thing again. It's just like, yeah. Oh my God, like I'm up here with Dan Aykroyd, who I used to watch, so that, yeah. Like also Steve Martin, I had the same feeling whenever he hosted eventually, but I met him a couple times, like that thing of like, I can't believe I'm meeting Steve Martin.
So this is like one of the tribe things, like where you realize that your whole, cause the second you're cast on SNL, like really your life changes completely in a way that's like, winning the lottery or I don't know, like it changes in a million ways that you can't begin to quantify or understand how much it's like a process because nobody is famous when they get the show and you sort of suddenly become associated with this incredible American brand and that just sort of develops throughout your life. So it was like maybe my, I'm going to say seventh week early. I was new, I was scared. It was cold. So it must've been like November and I was walking. It was like right after maybe the tree had gone up and around New York just becomes like impossible log jam, 6th Avenue, like 14th Street all the way up to, the park basically. So I was walking and walking and walking and walking to get a cab down to Soho on Friday night after rehearsal. And I was like kind of, new in town, didn't know anybody really and couldn't get a cab. It was like 20 blocks. And I was just sort of doing the thing where you walk in New York with your arm up, like hoping that a cab would come. And a cab pulls up and the door opens. And literally from inside the cab, a voice goes, Anna, get in, Aykroyd, I'll give you a ride. And it was one of those things where I was just like, what is happening? Like,
Dan, that's insane.
Like, how does he know who I am? Like, you know what I mean? And this was also like, I think just understanding sort of the wattage of what I was becoming. I was stunned. I couldn't believe
that's,
I knew him.
That's insane.
It was crazy. And I remember trying to pay for my part of the cab, like really nervously. You know what I mean? Because I was like, how much is it? I'm thinking
that's
like,
so cute.
Like he's really made it. Like he doesn't even need me to contribute for the cab.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. I didn't know.
Yeah. Do you guys just drive around in cabs now looking for
SNL cast
members?
Yeah, we do. We just try to pick
members,
up, just
pick up young hopefuls.
Yeah, pick up.
Get
yeah,
in.
Aristotle, Atari. And
Yeah.
Hey, but hop in.
And then
James
finally, I like to give comedians a chance to shout out other comedy comedians that are making you laugh right now. Is there anything that you've seen recently that really made you laugh?
This kid that Rachel and I both really like, Chris Fleming. He's so funny to me, man. He really
so
makes
funny.
Me laugh. There's something about his energy.
Like, he's already got a following, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair.
But, we're like, as oldies, we're like, there's a kid. Maybe you've heard
he's
of him.
Like, he's got
more
like
famous
3.4
than we are.
Million followers.
But he is hilarious in his brain. I don't even know, like, how it works.
Yeah, and actually, we send each other TikToks all the time. What's her name that we were just looking at who does this?
Oh, like, Jody.
Yeah, she's hilarious.
The woman that just, I don't even know her last name. The woman
she's
that does
TikTok.
Those, like, fake design.
She does, like, these design
shows. She does design show things, but it's all, like, a parody, so it's like.
And it's all, like, a mom.
I like to place this water bottle next to this sock to really bring out festive.
I like this Mitch. I like this shoe element
that
in my
really
foyer.
Spoke to me. But I wish I knew her last name.
I don't know her last name. So
her name's
right,
well,
shout out to Jody on TikTok who does
we'll
the
have
home
to look her up.
Shows.
Yeah,
and this youngster Chris Fleming, check him out.
We're getting the
all right. You guys getting
the hook.
We're getting the standing AV.
Well, I think we're done. So okay. So that's great. Thank you guys so much. This was really, really fun. And congrats on the movie.
Enjoy.
Have a good rest of your day. Oh,
all
yes.
Right,
happy
thanks
holidays.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
All right, that was so much fun. Thank you again to Rachel Dratch and Anna Gasteyer for coming on today's show. A Clusterfunk Christmas will be airing throughout the month of December on Comedy Central, Logo, and Pop TV. So if you too want to get in the holiday spirit, definitely go seek it out. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.